Hi, Patrick Cox here in Boston, and it's party time.
I need your dance. Accordion.
There is a reason for this music. The person behind it is a megastar in Ukraine. No, that's not the real reason. The real reason is that he, or is it she, speaks Sergic. Also today, the man who's speed-dated 37 languages is finally getting serious with one of them. He reveals his new language love exclusively in this pod.
Have an iPad, an iPhone, or an iPod Touch? You can now access this podcast on demand wherever you are, anytime through the PRI app. Listen to recent episodes or catch the world and other PRI programs live each day while on the go. Search under PRI in the iTunes App Store or simply click the link at theworld.org.
And theworld.org is where you go to for everything about the big show, The World, and its co-producers, PRI, the BBC, and WGBH in Boston. Go to theworld.org/language for notes on this pod episode. I post them also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. There's also a Facebook group page called The World in Words, and I'm on Twitter. Okay, so today we have two stories of people confronted by foreign languages. In one, the person embraces the language, and 36 others. In the other, a man, who's a teacher no less, he does not embrace the foreign language in question, which is Kurdish, even though his students speak that language, and they don't speak much of his, which is Turkish. Then, strap on your roller skates and apply some glitter, wherever you wish to apply it. We're going dancing with Ukraine's most eccentric performer, a man who has almost single-handedly elevated the status of a previously frowned-upon hybrid tongue. First of all, Keith Brooks. I originally did something on Keith about 15 months ago. He explained to me then how he wanted to learn a language, but he didn't know which language, so he was going to try out 37 languages and write about each of them in his blog, which is called, appropriately enough, 37 Languages. If you want to hear my original report on Keith Brooks, it's in The World in Words, number 41. Here, though, is a short extract from that report laying out the Keith Brooks method.
Brooks spends a few days in the company of a language, say Finnish or Serbian. He studies the language's history and culture, its writing system, its grammar, and of course, the richness of its vocabulary. Then he writes it up in his blog. Since December, he's done this with 13 languages. This, by the way, is part one of the process.
It sounds as though part one is like speed dating.
Yes. That's exactly what it would be if it were dating.
If it were dating? Well, after Brooks has speed-dated 37 languages, he's really excited about Armenian. After that, he'll drop all but 10 of them.
And then you've got these 10 that you're going to go on a real date with.
Yes. Those 10 languages, they'll, I guess, get a call back. And I will do a more extensive review of those languages. I'll use the writing system. I'll speak in the tongue of those languages. And that'll probably be at least a week per language.
A whole week? Now there's commitment.
Well, Keith did all of that. He wrote detailed posts on all 37 languages from stage one. He evaluated each language with points out of 5 for things like intelligibility, complexity, and resonance. And then he started stage 2. And would you believe it? Only 6 languages, not 10, got the call back. Keith clearly is a hard man to please. Anyway, I caught up with Keith earlier this week. He agreed to reveal his chosen language and so much more exclusively to the pod. Here's our conversation. So last time we spoke, Keith, you were about, what, a third of the way through part one of this process. You were a third of the way through speed dating your 37 languages. By the time you were done with all of those languages, you must have been flat out exhausted.
I was very exhausted. I just didn't assume that going through 37 languages would take so much time.
So much time meaning per language. How long did it take?
Well, the goal was to do each language for a couple of days, but in some cases it extended to a week or several weeks for certain languages.
That's quite a long date.
Yeah.
What do you put that down to? Did you just sort of get into the language and couldn't walk away?
Well, I do a lot of things in my spare time outside of, you know, my job and then the language blog. And then another factor was just trying to summarize everything I learned about them. That was probably the most time-consuming part, along with the things people told me, whether it be from native speakers or commenters from the blog. So just trying to congregate all of those things was also time-consuming.
Do you have a sense of what this was all doing to your brain at the time?
Exhaustion. I think I was able to pick up on things much more quickly. When I was looking at some of these Slavic languages in the first part, I was able to pick up much more on certain vocabulary, word order, the grammar. So it kind of just seemed familiar.
Did you get confused between languages? Would you sort of, you know, spout a little bit of Japanese instead of Chinese or Croatian instead of Serbian?
Yeah, that actually did happen at some points. I think once I got to Danish, I was, you know, trying to go through certain words, and for some reason I just confused them with Norwegian ones and then Swedish ones, because Danish and Swedish or Norwegian, they're all mutually intelligible. So that kind of happened a lot. And then with Albanian, there are certain words that are similar to other words in Indo-European languages. For example, the word green, I kept confusing that with the Spanish word, which is verde. So that kind of happened a lot.
So what is green in Albanian?
I think it's verde. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Well, I'll check and make a note of that at the end, yeah. So six of the languages got a call back.
Yes.
Which languages and why?
The languages I selected were Norwegian, Portuguese, Croatian, Swedish, Turkish, and Albanian. And I think the reason I chose all of those, the biggest factor is that I had the most fun with those languages. And I had, you know, a breeze going through the grammar of those languages. And also just they are much more accessible than some of the other languages I looked at.
That's an interesting group of languages. I mean, they're all European or sort of on the edge of Europe. And with the exception of Portuguese, none of them could be described as a major language.
Yeah, I would say that amongst all of them, Portuguese was actually a very big surprise. I didn't assume I would be looking at any Romance languages. And when I did look at it in part one, I kind of dismissed it as, you know, being a, maybe this might not be the right thing to say, but a duplicate of Spanish. But I was very surprised at, you know, listening to it. It sounds nothing like Spanish. And then the grammar and just speaking it is so much fun. So along with that, all of these languages, they're not really, I suppose, popular languages from an American sense, but they're still equally as interesting as the popular ones people tend to study.
And for this round, how much more time did you spend with each of these languages?
For each language in part two, I spent a total of 1 week. And in that time, I spoke the language, I recited it, I learned to use the writing system, and the most major part was speaking it with native speakers. So for each language, I was able to do that, with the exception of Albanian, unfortunately.
So you found people who you could have a basic conversation with?
Yes.
So what do we call that in what do we call that in dating terms? Is this hand-holding? Getting frisky?
Maybe third base.
Oh, quite a ways along. Okay, all right. What was going through your mind while you were speaking each of these languages? Were you kind of asking yourself, is this the one? And how were you trying to assess whether or not, you know, you really wanted to sink yourself into one of these languages?
Each time I was able to speak the language I selected, I kept imagining if I could do this repeatedly and if it would come easier to me. And then along with that, I, you know, read it at the same time I spoke it, and then just tried to figure out if this came across naturally, I guess a more, if it was organic, as opposed to just, you know, trying it and then having it appear fake or false.
And I did see that with one of the languages, I can't remember which, you note in a blog post that you believe that you had actual thoughts in that language at some points, which was always an incredibly exciting moment in learning a language.
Yeah, that actually happened with Danish. I think once I was dreaming, and I can't remember the details in the beginning, but I know at the end, I was at a store and I was just walking around and I heard people speaking Danish, and all of a sudden I got excited and I just screamed, Podunsk, Podunsk, which in Danish means in Danish. So that was that was really exhilarating for that to happen to me.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. That's great. Did this time round, the second stage round, did that tell you more about the process of learning a language than first time around?
Yes, I would say that in terms of learning a language, it's much more fun and it's actually much better to learn it as opposed to learning it from a classroom. And I found myself with these final six languages knowing much more, not comprehending the language, but knowing almost as much as some of the language I studied before, like Spanish and French, and in some cases, even more.
Knowing it by speaking it and reading it and immersing yourself, you mean just a week of that actually gave you more of a mastery of the language than sitting in a classroom for years on end?
Exactly. Yes. I immerse myself in listening to new segments, music from that language, speaking it with people, and just reading it. And I think I have a better sense of some of these languages than probably Spanish, which was the one I was the most familiar with. And I find myself also forgetting words in Spanish and also words in other languages I was already familiar with from the blog.
And just so I'm straight, just during that sort of week of immersion, how much English did you speak?
I tried to keep it at a minimum. I greeted people in the languages that were from part two.
If you were speaking to a friend or a work colleague or something, you suddenly break out into Albanian to them?
Yes. Yeah. Especially when I was learning certain sentences and phrases, sometimes I would just say something like, in Turkish, yashasin, which is like hooray. It was a part of, I guess, reciting that language.
You must have become the office eccentric there for a while.
I think I'm already the office eccentric.
Okay, so here's the big moment then. Tell us, okay, which language you picked as, I don't know how to describe it, as your life partner?
Well, it was a really difficult decision. I hope I don't regret it, but I think the language I'm going to go with is Norwegian.
Oh, well, congratulations, Norway. Wow, that's amazing. That's great.
Yeah.
I remember you saying it was an early favorite. It was something that you liked, and along with a number of other languages, that you were hot for Norwegian from, you know, a long way back.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually mentioned something about, now, I don't know if I can get this right, the retroflex of its trills. Did I get that the right way around?
Yes, yeah. Trilled retroflexes.
Yeah, I just thought that was delightful. Could you give me an example of Norwegian's trilled retroflexes?
In the word from, which is in Norwegian fra, the R is kind of trilled. So it's fra. Like if you were saying a sentence, I come from Norway, it would be jeg kommer fra Norg.
Oh, very nice. That would make my eyes flutter a little bit. So now that you've made this decision, what are you going to do? What's next?
Well, the goal is to learn the language to a really high degree of fluency, and then possibly visit the country, learn more about Norway itself, and also see if I could find some opportunities, maybe opportunities in employment, opportunities for just having an ability to write and speak the language. So pretty much it's anything can happen, but I do plan to use it daily and speak it daily.
As you look back now on all of these languages that you've learned just a little bit about, and this one that you're now going to learn an awful lot about, would you recommend this as a way for others to arrive at a language that they would like to learn?
Well, I can definitely say that some people have already started to take this approach, and are doing it in similar ways and sometimes much more extreme ways. There's a blogger that does this project called 52 Languages, where he's learning about a language each week for a year. And then there are other people. There's this blogger named Benny. He's called the Irish Polyglot, where he goes to each country to essentially learn the language. So this method I would definitely recommend. However, I would probably, if I could go back, I would probably get rid of the evaluations I had for each language in part one. And I think maybe that's because I came at the project from the perspective of as an American English speaker. But essentially, I don't think there's a way to evaluate a language. I mean, that's really just impossible. Each of these languages had some sort of feature that was interesting or something appealing about it. So I would definitely probably discourage trying to evaluate the language.
Just move on to the next speed dating partner.
Exactly.
Well, Keith Brooks, congratulations. Thank you very much, and good luck with Norwegian.
Thank you very much, or rather, tusen takk.
Wow. What's Keith going to do with all of that spare time? I mean, only one language to study? Will he be faithful, or will he crack open a Portuguese dictionary when he thinks no one's looking? The word for green in Albanian, by the way, is... well, I have absolutely no idea how to pronounce this, but let me spell it for you. It's two words. The first word is just one letter, the letter E. Second word, G-J-E-L-B-E with a little umlaut on the top, R. Green in Albanian. Now to, well, the opposite of Keith Brooks, and it is about the standoff in Turkey between Turkish and Kurdish. You may have heard a piece, rather nice one, that we ran in The World in Words number 78, on the letters Q, W, and X. These are letters that are prohibited in Turkey because Turkish doesn't use them. They're not in the Turkish language. But Kurdish does. And Kurdish has long been suppressed in Turkey because it's considered to be a cornerstone of Kurdish nationalist rights. But things are changing, slowly. The current Turkish government is trying to essentially decriminalize Kurdish and remove many of the restrictions on its use. So you can broadcast in Kurdish now. You can even use it in the national parliament. But there is tremendous opposition to this. Imagine the opposition to Spanish in certain parts of the United States, but way, way more intense. That's the backdrop for a new film directed by two Kurdish filmmakers. It's an attempt to explain to the broader Turkish public just how the old restrictions, some of which are still in place, just how difficult they make day-to-day life for Kurdish speakers. The reporter is the BBC's Jonathan Head.
A young schoolgirl recites the patriotic chant that starts and ends the week in classrooms across Turkey. O great Ataturk, she chants, I vow to follow the path you blazed. May my existence be a gift to the nation. Then she finishes with the famous quote, happy is the person who can call herself a Turk. But this girl is not a Turk, she's Kurdish, and she can barely understand what it is that she's chanting. She's one of the characters in a remarkable new documentary which follows the trials of a first-time teacher sent to an impoverished village in the country's mainly Kurdish southeast. The teacher, Emre, struggles to communicate with children who speak no Turkish, the only language allowed in Turkish schools. He, of course, speaks no Kurdish. Every night he bemoans his impossible situation on the phone to his mother in the West. There's nothing here, Mum, he complains. I knew I'd be coming to a village, but I never imagined it would be such a bad place. He's right. The village is shockingly poor, its inhabitants eking out a hard-scrabble existence in the stony fields. But the power of the film is the way it presents Emre's problem over language, a situation for which he's completely unprepared thanks to decades of official denial of the Kurdish identity. Co-director Orhan Eskiköy spent a year filming Emre throughout his first year in the village.
Biz filme başlamadan önce buna karar vermiştik. From the very beginning, we decided to make a film where there is no way for the audience to avoid the core problem. We wanted them to sympathize with both the teacher and the children.
Rahatsız olma. Siz yapamadınız, biz yaptık. Devam ediyor. Bundan sonra da kararını vereceğiz. Rahatsız olma.
The government has been trying to end the rift between Turks and Kurds.
Onun için rahatsız oluyorsunuz. Zaten sıkıntının altında yatan temel esas bu.
Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan lambasting the opposition parties in parliament recently for contesting his reforms, which would lift many of the restrictions on using Kurdish. Hostility to these reforms runs high among nationalist Turks. They challenge the entrenched ideology of a nation built solely on ethnic Turkish foundations. And the country's courts are vigilant in upholding this official view. The main criminal court in Istanbul's Beşiktaş district. A gaggle of supporters cheers as police buses bring in young men accused of political violence. Some are Kurds, some leftists. Also waiting for his turn in court is an older man. This is Recep Zarakol, and he's nothing more than a publisher. Yet he's been repeatedly put on trial and jailed. This time it's on charges of spreading terrorist propaganda because of a novel he published about a young man who chooses to join Kurdish rebels in the mountains.
Unfortunately, Turkish prosecutors feel themselves as a defender of the official ideology and official history, and they acting like a militant than a judge or a prosecutor, a part of the law. This is a real problem, unfortunately.
Orhan Eskikoy's gentle film, centered on Kurdish children and their bewildered teacher, may escape that fate, but it still carries a powerful message.
Aslında iki dili ve iki kültürü, iki kimliği biz aslında filmin sonunda eşitliyoruz.
At the end of the film, we try to equalize the two languages, cultures and identities. That's the message we try to get across to the audience, that these children have the same right to live and be educated as anyone else in this country.
At the end of the film, Emre leaves, having learnt just three words of Kurdish. His pupils have done little better. Yet, in their own language, the film shows, they actually have plenty to say.
Okay, major tone change coming up. Ready? We are about to enter the world of Verka Serduchka. She is one of the biggest pop stars and actresses in Ukraine. Well, actually, Serduchka isn't really a singer. She's not really an actress. In fact, she's not even a she. This is someone with serious identity issues, which makes her, or him, an appropriate representative of Ukraine itself. And this identity crisis extends, as it so often does in Ukraine, to language. And on that count, get ready to hear about Sergic. No, I had no idea either. Bridget McCarthy is in Kiev. She has this profile of Verka Serduchka.
Hello. My name is Verka Serduchka.
Superstar. Mama. Megastar.
Verka Serduchka is a pop culture phenomenon in Ukraine. She's all over magazine covers, on billboards, and for a while, even on jars of mayonnaise and vodka. But what is she exactly?
Ukrainian Cinderella.
This Cinderella wears gaudy sequined dresses, big sunglasses, and flamboyant hats. Her favorite these days is a sparkly silver swim cap with a huge star on top. And then there's Verka's bust. To call it huge really doesn't do it justice. Alas, it's fake, because this Cinderella is actually a fella, a 37-year-old comedian named Andrei Danilko. But Danilko insists Verka Serduchka is not a man in drag.
I really don't like it when people say, I perform as a woman. I don't. I perform characters, and characters can be any type of character. It doesn't really matter.
Out of costume, Andrei Danilko is soft-spoken and shy, wearing jeans and a baseball cap. Starting as a teenager, he brought to life on stage characters that are pulled straight from the daily tribulations of Ukrainian life. A semi-literate policeman, a surly cafeteria worker dishing out slop in a factory canteen. But Verka Serduchka has always been the crowd favorite and a barometer of the national mood. In her own brassy, proudly ignorant way, Serduchka takes on some of Ukraine's most polarizing issues. She tramples all over the country's sore spots, turning them into the stuff of comedy. And as Ukraine has changed, so has Verka Serduchka. 18 years ago, she was a classic Soviet character, a bossy middle-aged train conductor. She wore bright blue eyeshadow, an ill-fitting brown skirt, and baggy cotton tights. She prowled the aisles, harassing riders. Part of the humor in these early skits was linguistic. Verka spoke a mangled mixture of Ukrainian and Russian known as surzhik, a dialect common among rural and working-class Ukrainians.
That's how people talked at school, and I still keep talking that way. Sometimes I get really confused and I can't separate two languages in my head.
Verka made surzhik funny, not shameful. No one had ever done that. In the late 1990s, Verka Serduchka got her own TV show. As Ukraine evolved into a bilingual nation, Verka cleaned up her language, speaking either proper Russian or Ukrainian. And she ditched her train whistle for a feather boa and sunglasses, becoming a parody of Ukraine's embrace of kitschy consumerism. A few years ago, Danilko discovered that this girl of his could sing. Verka Serduchka has sold more than 2 million CDs in Ukraine and Russia, and her songs have become standards at Ukrainian weddings. Poor Verka has never had much luck with men. In her skits and music videos, her wide-eyed peasant mother is her most frequent sidekick. Still, Verka once danced with President Lukashenko of Belarus, and she almost kissed Vladimir Putin.
I was at a party where Putin was, and I was as Verka, and during my skit I showed him, come over here, but he said, no, you come over here.
Maybe it was a symbolic moment. Verka, like Ukraine, has had some trouble figuring out this business of independence from Russia. For years, Russians were her biggest audience. They loved to laugh at Verka Serduchka's parodies of Ukrainian stereotypes. But some Ukrainian patriots hated it. 3 years ago, Verka actually got to represent Ukraine in the Eurovision Song Contest. Ukrainian nationalists staged protests and burned her in effigy.
And when I was watching this on TV, I was shocked.
But an even bigger shock came after her Eurovision performance.
I love you.
Russian nationalists claim to hear the words Russia goodbye. Danilko says that's not what he said. No matter, Verka was blacklisted on Russian TV and had lucrative concert tours there canceled. Suddenly, Danilko was forced to take sides.
I always considered myself a Ukrainian artist. I was never a Russian artist.
At the same time, Danilko says, Ukrainians and Russians are profoundly shaped by a common culture. They're all children of the Soviet Union. These days, though, Verka's no longer just looking east. It's not clear what her next act is, but she, or rather Andrei Danilko, is learning English so he can bring his wacky Ukrainian brand of humor to audiences in Europe and America.
See you soon!
See you soon!
Bye! For The World, I'm Bridget McCarthy in Kiev, Ukraine.
Okay, okay, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Blah, blah, okay.
I need your dance.
I'll post some Verka Serduchka photos and video at theworld.org/language, also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can post your comments and suggestions there, or on Facebook at the World in Words group page, or you can tweet me, or you can email me. The address is language@pri.org. No Ukrainian disco next week. Hand on heart.